Welcome to In the Wake with Whitley. Here on this podcast, we cover mental health, life lessons, mindset growth, and tons of storytelling. Together, we'll laugh, we'll cry, and everything in between. I'm your host, Whitley Rogers. I'm a certified life coach and mental health advocate. I'm also a survivor of sexual and mental abuse. I'm here to open up those conversations that are normally uncomfortable or hush-hush in society. Keep listening for bits and pieces of my personal journey and insights along with other interviewees. This is a trigger warning to preface this episode. This episode may include explicit content, graphic details, or heavier, sensitive, and mature topics. Listen at your own risk and take precaution if you suffer with a mood or mental disorder, suicidal ideation, or a victim of abuse, rape, or trauma. The following episode could contain such content. The last thing I want is for this episode to trigger or provoke negative thoughts or feelings for you. All right, I am back. Here with me today is another new guest, Katie. I am very excited because this is a topic I am very passionate about. So I'm glad that we are going to be covering it today. So hi, Katie, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit? Like, who are you and what is your story?
Hi, thank you so much for having me here today. I'm really excited to be here and share more about my background and my story. So in 2016, in the summer, I was sexually assaulted. And shortly after that, I kind of started drinking heavily to cope with it. I had a hard time. It was kind of in a dark place. It was hard to talk about. And then I just realized I was kind of going down that path and decided to stop. So I took time off from that and it kind of built from there. But in 2016, when the election hit, it really shook me. Like, I think a lot of people, it just it shook me to my core. I was just shocked and I felt like I couldn't stay silent anymore. Mm. So the next day I kind of just started speaking out everywhere about it because I think the shock factor of the situation pushed me to that level. So I started telling everybody and I was so upset. And then that point kind of launched me into sharing more. And I started talking at colleges in my local community about it. A year later after my trauma, I went through the criminal justice process. For a lot of survivors, it's not a great experience. So I went through the detectives and district attorneys, and it was a very long, drawn out process with lots of meetings. And ultimately, even with a DNA kit, a phone call, they interviewed my perpetrator. They said I had no evidence to my case. Mm. I really felt like a year of my life was almost like taken from that. And right. So I wanted to keep speaking out because I just felt like even within that system, there was so much reform that needs to happen. So I felt very passionate about sharing that with people so they kind of know the ins and outs of what really happens to survivors. So that's kind of where my passion for being loud about this came from.
Okay, I have so many questions. When you were sexually assaulted, was it someone you knew?
No, it wasn't. Actually, this kind of shares within my story. 2 weeks before it happened, I was traveling over in Amsterdam and Ireland by myself. Mm-hmm. And it was a really big deal for me because it was my first time doing a solo trip overseas.
Yeah.
So I went there and, you know, when you prepare for that, a lot of times people tell you like, oh, well, you need to be careful. Like basically you could get raped, something could happen to you. And I went there. I had a beautiful time. I met amazing people. Nothing dangerous happened. So I think I came back on this high of feeling independent and strong and brave.
Right.
And then 2 weeks after that, when I was back with my friend going on a night out, having that happen, it was just like, wow, people prepare you to say that this could happen if you go traveling, but to have it happen in your own backyard was devastating.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important that you mentioned the 2016 election, because I know as a survivor myself, like, it's really disappointing and it's really discouraging to have the person that's leading our country be a perpetrator and an abuser and a narcissist, because yes. Then it's like, if all of these people are supporting a rapist, then I don't feel like I am supported in society. I don't feel like I'm taken seriously and believed, because obviously that's not a big enough indicator for many people to not support him. Just seeing like all of the men that are getting away with it and that are still living their lives with no consequences, no accountability, and they're being supported. They're being like in these high positions with power. It's just really, really discouraging some days. It really weighs me down.
Yeah, I feel you on that. I think that when it happened, my immediate reaction was like, I saw my rapist in him. Yeah. And that's all I could see for months when that happened. It was like, if the news was on, it was so triggering. And I know it's triggering for a lot of people, because that's all I could see in watching his anger, like the way he spoke, anything. It just, that's what I saw.
Yeah, I know. I have a friend as well. I actually had her on the podcast and she talked about this as well. She had a really bad mental breakdown when he won, just because as a survivor, that's heavy and that's discouraging, especially with the justice system not being in your favor majority of the time.
Yeah.
You know, not getting justice and then also having people in power. It's frustrating.
Definitely. It's almost like hard to put words into it, because it is heavy. That's a good word for it. It's very heavy.
It really is. And I think it's cool that that was what catapulted you into your advocacy. And instead of kind of letting it get to you and bring you down, you were like, I'm going to fight because this is happening.
Yeah. Just thinking about everyone I've ever come into contact, like people from college, people from high school, people I've met here in San Diego, I felt like if people saw a face as a survivor, if you knew that this happened to me and you know me, maybe you would think differently about having this person in power and what's happening. I think I do surround myself with a lot of people who did not vote that way. I just felt this need to like make it known and to just say, hey, this is not okay. This is what this man represents. And you know me, and this happened to me. So now you have a face to understand what a survivor is feeling right now.
Right. What was the climax or turning point for you? Like, how did you start your journey of healing and recovery from this?
I would say, so I almost had like two turning points. One I kind of shared with the election, but the other one I would say, my trauma happened in July of 2016.
Right.
And then around August, September, I was drinking heavily because I just wanted to pretend like there was no pain. So I'd just drink to like not remember things. It was really unhealthy. I wasn't sleeping. I would like fall asleep on my classroom floor and be taking naps there during the day. Like, it was very not character of me. And I don't know exactly what kind of the light bulb went off, but I just know one day I woke up and I felt terrible. And I felt so dark. And I just thought, if I keep doing this, I know I will be going down a dark road. So at that point, I decided, why don't I take a month off drinking and see how I feel? I'll just start with a month and see if that makes a difference for me. Because I had to eliminate something to try to cope with the pain. So I feel like that moment was a turning point, just to have that recognition that the path I was going down was going to make everything worse. And then that month turned into several months, and I took like a year off to really focus on my healing. Within that time, I traveled a lot and saw a lot of healers, went to lots of different types of therapy, a lot of different strategies to support healing. So that was definitely a turning point that got me to focus on the healing on a really deep level.
Yeah, I think that's so important to take out the numbing factor, because it's trauma, it's traumatic. And so it can be hard to actually face all of those emotions and process them. So I think that's really big of you to like eliminate that numbing factor and then cope in a more healthy way. That's hard. That's very hard work.
It was really hard. To this day, it's probably one of the hardest things I've done. Just, I think our culture in America is very alcohol friendly and very drinking based. So it was took a lot of strength to kind of be in situations where I would normally lean towards that, especially to numb the pain and to kind of say no and rise above that. Try my best to remember that the healing needed to just happen. That pain was going to carry on for so much longer and to drag it out if I did not make that decision.
Yeah, you can't keep shoving it down forever. At some point, it's going to boil up and it's going to be hard once it does.
Yes, I actually heard a survivor say once that the trauma is almost like an orca that lives below the surface. And then every once in a while, it comes out and really pops out and you feel it. Like it's always living below the surface. And when she described that, I felt like it was so accurate that some days it's just below the surface and then you don't always know when it's going to surface out.
Yeah, I love that. I've never heard of that. So you mentioned you went to therapy. What was that like for your healing? And were there any other big factors that played a part in your healing process?
Yeah, so I tried a lot of different therapists, and I made an episode about this on my podcast because I feel like it's really important to find the right therapist that fits your needs. And during that time, I tried a few. The first one I went to, actually, she was supposed to specialize in trauma, domestic violence, sexual assault. And she asked me, do you think this would have happened to you if you knew self-defense? And it was like, are you serious right now? So I had to drop that one, but I went through a few different ones. At one point, I was seeing a teletherapist, and she taught me like tapping techniques to deal with tension in your body, and that was really helpful. I think one of the most healing ones for me is I had a psychiatrist that was trying to encourage me to go to a PTSD program, an outpatient program. It was pretty intense, like because it was like 3 hours a day. But for me, luckily, I have summers off. So it just seemed like the universe lined it up for me to attend it. And I went through that program for like several weeks, I think like 8 to 10 weeks. And it was 3 hours a day, 3 to 4 days a week. And that was one of the most beneficial programs that really got me to a deeper level of healing. So it was group therapy and then some one-on-one. And then they taught a lot of meditation techniques, a lot of group support, something called ACT therapy, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. And I think some of it's like cognitive behavioral, but also being aware of your body and what your body's feeling, and then meditation and mindfulness. I would definitely recommend that therapy to people. And EMDR is another one that I did recently. And that one really released a lot of trauma I experienced from the criminal justice system, because that in itself brought on a whole nother level of trauma that I had to
That would make sense. So you struggled with PTSD after your assault, I'm assuming, since you went through that program?
Yes, I did. And I remember the first time I got told that, it just crushed me. And I was scared for a while because, I don't know, I got into this fear that I would somehow, if someone found out at my job, that I would lose my job. And then would I be able to work in the future if this is somehow in paperwork on my profile? So I struggled a lot with the PTSD label, but going through that program really made me see how the hypervigilance, like always wanting to look over my shoulder, the nightmares, flashbacks, triggers, all the things that a lot of people experience with PTSD, how if they could be managed and make progress in those areas, giving myself a higher quality of life, it really helped my healing to get past a lot of the things that were really putting me in survival mode every single day.
Yeah, because it's exhausting to live in survival mode.
Oh, it's so exhausting, and it even affects so much. Like if you are always in fight or flight, you don't get a chance to do rest and digest. And then it affects your appetite, it affects your sleep, everything. You're always tired. Everything feels like a chore. So I would say EMDR is a huge one too. It gets the trauma from our survival brain up front, so you can really talk about it and it's not so scary. I loved that therapy too. I felt like it was very healing to go through that.
Yes. Yes. I went through EMDR as well. I've heard a lot of survivors have done it as well, and it's super effective.
Yeah. I will say too, just because it's a little interesting, I went to Bali like shortly after the election, which was a saving grace to fly away and go to Bali for 10 days.
Here.
So that was good timing. But when I was there, I saw a medicine man, actually the son of Katut from Eat, Pray, Love. I saw him.
Oh, really? Wow.
And that was really awesome to do that in the healing process. And then I saw a Reiki healer. And I think Reiki can also be a really awesome tool. It felt really good to just have someone affirm what I was going through and make me feel like you're not alone. This isn't your fault. And just help calm the body, because the body, it just doesn't feel safe after a trauma like that.
Yeah. And I love that you have explored so many different routes in your healing process. It sounds like you've really dove into so many different areas. And I love that.
Yeah, I know too, like when I speak on therapy, I also know that not everyone can afford it. Mm-hmm. So I know too, like one thing that I did immediately after the trauma, when I took a month off work, which was also scary to navigate, I was afraid everyone would find out what happened to me. But during that time, I cooked every day. And I feel like cooking can be so healing, because you have a task you have to focus on. So it distracts the brain. Your hands are busy. I learned that your hands are how we release anger. Mm. And then also you get a reward at the end because you get to eat. So yeah. So that for me, for some reason, cooking and going through all the steps with that was really healing, keeping my hands busy, distracting my brain, and getting rewarded by what I made. And I feel like that could be such a healing tool.
I love that you mentioned that, because not everyone has access to therapy or mental health care. And you would never have thought that cooking could be such a release and so healing. So I love that you mentioned that. Thank you. All right. So how has stigma or shame played a part in your story or even your healing process?
I was thinking a lot on this and trying to reflect. I would say for me, shame really came up a couple times. One is when I first told some of my friends. I had one friend say, like, well, were you drinking a lot? Like, did you say no? So I think the questions people ask can make you feel that shame. At least for me, it did.
Right.
And sharing with family too, I think, really brought it on, because I didn't want my family to start seeing me in a different light or perspective than they originally did. And I was afraid of like what perspective shift that would bring on and how they viewed me. And just sharing, when you share a trauma like that, it's already hard because it's a trauma and it's violence. But I think given the context of it, it can be uncomfortable to feel like you're sharing about your sex life too.
Yeah.
Siblings. Yeah. So for me, that brought on shame, but definitely the questions that can be asked. Because I think the indirect message that happens when people ask those questions is we're telling survivors, I don't believe you.
Mm-hmm. Definitely how people respond to your story can bring about a lot of shame and victim blaming.
Yes, the victim blaming, I think, in itself brings out the shame. And I think, too, something I was talking about this week with another podcast was a lot of times people don't realize that when you are in a trauma like that, your body decides for you on how it's going to keep you safe. Mm-hmm. So people think like you should fight back or you should run away, but freeze is a huge response that's not talked about. My body froze up. My body just froze. I felt like I couldn't talk. I couldn't move. And when you go through that and it's not commonly talked about that freeze can happen, you feel like the shame of like, well, why couldn't I move? Why couldn't I tell him no? I wanted to. I wanted to yell. I wanted to get away. But your body is just deciding like, this is how I'm going to keep you safe in this moment, because there's a threat, there's a danger, and this is how I'm going to keep you safe. So I think there's shame when you first feel like betrayed by your body. You feel like, why didn't I have the control to stop this? I felt I had to work through shame in that sense too.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. And I'm curious, because you were on this high of feeling so strong and so independent after traveling. Did you feel shame afterwards being assaulted, of kind of like no longer feeling strong, no longer feeling independent? And I know for me, it was humiliating, like my abuse. It was like, how? Like, it's just so hard to like comprehend how all of this happened, how you got in this situation. So yeah, I'm curious to know how that played out.
Yeah. And I'm sorry for your situation as well. I agree. I think the context of knowing that I had been on this beautiful trip by myself, traveling, I felt so independent, and it really opened doors. I was like, right. Wow, if I can do this, I can go to a lot more places by myself, and I'm going to keep traveling by myself. Like, I don't need someone else to agree to my trip and come on. Like, if people aren't available, I can do this. Yeah, I was on a whole nother level of strength, independence, feeling on this cloud nine. So there was some shame, and humiliation is a good word for it, because there was one level of this high and then immediate low when that happened. Feeling like, oh my gosh, I thought I was strong. I thought I had this. And then, wow, I'm not. Someone can hurt me so easily, and I never saw this coming. Kind of questioning and blaming yourself. Why didn't I keep myself safe? That was really hard to work through. I think shame comes from that as well.
Yeah. So I think the shame and the stigma plays a big part in the victim blaming. So I guess for anyone that isn't aware of this term, what is victim blaming and why is it so harmful?
I think victim blaming is putting all of the responsibility on a sexual assault on the victim and making it that the victim was supposed to have all the power in making a situation not happen, when really the rapist or perpetrator, it's violence done to someone. And so I think that is victim blaming, is making it that the survivor should have done everything to stop it. And on that note too, I was talking to one survivor a few years ago who, she was in DC, so she had to deal with like the Department of Justice, like some big level stuff. She was telling me, you know, when people make it about you should have fought back, it's basically saying like you should have risked your life and risked a higher level of violence, like even death, to prevent something. And it's like, why are we rewarding that only if you would have fought to a level that you could have gotten even more injured, that is the solution and that you should have done that? That mentality, I think, too, is blaming. And it's something that the criminal justice system, they only take cases to court, slam dunk cases is what we call it, that they know they will win. Usually it's that situation of fighting back, that they'll take situations like that because they're only going to take what they're going to win because they get reelected off conviction rates. Even that information kind of ties into the whole victim blaming. I think it's harmful because it just perpetuates this myth that women or men too are fully responsible for someone else's violence done to them. And it kind of lets violence continue to happen. And like you said earlier, that a lot of these rapists or men can get away with their behavior because no matter what, we're going to question everything about the victim. And and sending that message that I don't believe you. I mean, not being believed is, I think, one of the most painful things, especially when you've gone through something insanely traumatic, painful, life-altering, and to be told, I basically don't believe you unless you've done everything to prevent this when really you couldn't.
Yeah, I've heard this term of like the perfect victim, where if you're not, then people are blaming you or don't believe you. And really, I've experienced like when people don't believe me, it's like, why would I make this up? Like,
yes.
Why would I create this whole story? Like, I'm not getting anything from this. I haven't gotten justice. I'm not getting like praise. This is humiliating to like share my story that this happened to me. So it's just so frustrating when people don't believe you, because it's like, I don't understand how you can think like women or even men would just create this sick story.
Yes, that is how I felt. Why would I make this up? Why would I put myself through this? You know, like it's so painful. I wouldn't want to send myself through this. And I remember being in the detective room and sitting there and just realizing when he looked at me that all he saw was a victim and that I was a number. Mm-hmm. It just felt like, okay, here I am. I'm just another person sitting here going to tell you my story and just being questioned constantly. I don't even know to the level they questioned my perpetrator, because what they told me was like, the questions they asked him and his responses, they just took on face value. Yeah, I think it's the level of like a perpetrator being questioned and whatever he answers, it's so easy for them to say he didn't do it. But on the victim side, they question you to an extent of like constantly not believing you. Like the concept that you have to prove it, like you need to come here and prove it, I think can be very victim blaming too.
And I know, like, I read Chanel Miller's story at the beginning of this year, and it was like she had witnesses, she had the DNA, she had all this evidence, and still she wasn't believed. She didn't get her justice. He only had 3 months in jail, and everyone was worried about his future and his life. And it's like, what about her future? Her life has been altered forever. This is going to affect her and change her forever. And she had all the right things and still didn't get justice. And that's just so disheartening as a victim to see that. And it's like, what else do you need?
Yeah, exactly. It's so true. I remember them telling me that they were going to question like so much about my character and like your history. And then with him too, he had a criminal background. Right. I mean, already like he's got crimes on his background. That should be something. And even the idea of he took my phone away when I tried to call an Uber to leave at first. So being told like it has to be through fear or force, and then, oh, well, this wasn't through fear or force. I mean, how are we defining that? Because the moment my phone got taken away, the fear was put in place at that moment.
Right.
I mean, if someone does something like that, it's still an aggressive move that tells me I'm not in a safe situation because I tried to just leave and this person took something from me that was an outlet to leave. So yeah, I know the whole his future over her future. It's so disgusting.
Yeah. So how did you learn to no longer blame yourself? I know victim blaming, it doesn't always have to come from other people, that sometimes we can internalize that. So yeah, what has that looked like for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think too, having a strong support system really helps. Having a lot of very supportive friends that will tell you this is not your fault. I know too, there's like, I joined some Facebook groups of survivors, and that was very helpful to just connect with other people going through this to know like, it's not my fault. I think part of it was my age because, I mean, I've had some trauma in the past, which I won't get into right now. But when this happened, stood out the most for me, I was 27. And I think because I had just come back from a trip of traveling alone and feeling strong, I think that my age helped me to have all this time in the past that formed my identity prior to the trauma that happened, so that I could see like, this isn't mine to carry. Like, he should feel ashamed. Like, he is the problem and he should be carrying my shame and the blame and not me. I think connecting with other survivors was one thing. Getting the support from other women to remind me this wasn't my fault. I also had an advocate. So I know a lot of crisis centers can assign you an advocate for free. So I always tell people that's a good resource. And just always checking in with my advocate on a monthly basis was very helpful to not blame myself. Therapy, I think a lot of factors came together to teach me to not blame myself. And the speaking out, like going to the events like Take Back the Night, going and talking to college students that were training to help victims and being a panelist and sharing my story like over and over. It just, I think always the feedback of like, you aren't alone, this isn't your fault. And hearing that so many times helped me get to that place of knowing like it was not my fault.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. Just being like validated and hearing other people's stories, it's like, oh, this is real. Like, I'm not making this up. I'm not crazy. This does happen. And yeah, that validation and then being like empowered and buoyed up by other survivors and your support system can really help.
Yes, I think hearing the stories, you recognize stuff in other people's stories and the empathy of feeling for what they went through and connecting it to your story. Validation is so key in not blaming yourself.
Yeah. So what has it looked like to take your power back after your assault?
Well, one is speaking out. But when I went through more intensive outpatient therapy, I somehow got to a place through meditation, through that program, where I started to meditate on not just forgiveness per se, because I never want to tell anybody they need to forgive.
Yes. Yeah.
But I felt like if my perpetrator could get to a place where he had love and peace and kindness in his heart, I think when someone operates on that energy level, my hope would be that they're not harming people. Mm-hmm. So I think getting to a place of sending that intentions out in the world was healing for me and made me realize that I had more power when I'm operating on a level that's to my fullest potential and having that support system and everyone around me validating me and telling me I'm strong and that I'm brave and speaking out and taking care of myself and getting to a level of feeling strong and knowing that my voice matters made me feel like I had more power again. I don't think it's a linear process. I think healing is always a back and forth. So I think that that's important too, because I definitely have days where I struggle with feeling like my power was taken. So it was up and down, because going through the district attorney, I'd go back down and feel like my power was gone again and I needed to get it back. But every time I talked and connected with survivors and just people who are supportive about this in general, I felt like I had power again, and that what I had to say, people needed to hear, and people wanted to hear it and tell me that it's not my fault. And seeing people be outraged by how I was treated by the district attorney, I actually posted a business card on a really famous Facebook page that was for Brock Turner for Prison. Mm-hmm. And now I'm involved in that organization. But at the time, I reached out to them and told them my story about how I was treated. And they let me post a business card of the district attorney that mishandled my case. Tons of people started calling that office and telling them that it wasn't right the way I was being treated and that they wanted justice for my case. I think that was one of the big moments that made me feel like I do have power and that my story matters and these people want to see justice for something that is wrong.
Yeah, I love how everyone rallied around you and that's beautiful. Yeah. So, okay, what does consent mean to you? And do you believe that consent education is important?
Yes, I actually just presented at a conference on consent education.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so I have been researching all about consent education. I've found a lot of resources. I've made some resources. Definitely passionate about consent. But I would say consent to me is two parties having a mutual agreement, both feel respected, that there's an understanding of what both people want and desire and what they're not comfortable with. So I'd say it's very mutual agreed upon decision making. I feel like consent to one of the things I learned through my research and reading was sometimes it's like the focus is on yes and no, and it has to be an enthusiastic yes, or it has to be a powerful no. But we can't take language and communication just on vocabulary words. Like, yeah, there's so much more to it. It's body language. Like, someone might say, oh, okay, like, sure. But if their tone is showing you, I really mean no, or they're looking down and their body language is saying no, that's a lot more than just the words yes and no. I think it's the culture behind it too is really important. And consent education to me is so important to start at an early age. So one of the things I focused on was bringing it to the preschool level, because a lot of what's out there is high school and middle school. And we don't have a lot on early education. But in that time period, the brain is learning fast, adapting. There's a lot of connections being made in children at a young age in early development. And they also are picking up on bias. There's a study that they already pick up on racial bias and gender bias at age 4. So if they're so impressionable by what we as adults are modeling for them, we really need to enforce consent as early as like 2 years old. I really think it has the potential for a lifelong impact, in the sense of if we're starting this really early and they are hearing this and it's being modeled for them across the lifespan, we could create a new generation with less violence, and just changing the culture around it too, that your body is yours, and like grandma and grandpa don't get to just tickle you because it's what they want. Like, you stand right. up for your body. I see a lot of value in starting it very young and carrying that out into adulthood.
Yeah, I think that is super important, because we usually just think of consent in terms of sex, but consent, yes. it's a respect of boundaries and your personal space. You should have consent when anyone is coming into your personal bubble or touching your body in any way, whether that's hugs or sharing toys or tickling, any of that. And that stuff happens when you're young, and you should feel like you have the choice to say no to grandparents or friends when you're not comfortable with that, when you have that boundary that you don't like to be hugged or you don't appreciate being tickled. Like, I think that's super, super important.
Children pick up on a lot. So if you want to preach consent, but then you're doing something else with another adult, like in front of them, oh, let's playful hitting, like stop it. It's sending the message still to that child that they're not in charge of their body. And mm-hmm. two, in the classroom, like, because I work in the schools, so I feel like there's so much emphasis on teaching children to be compliant all the time. Yeah. But if refusal is such an important skill, like I work with special needs children, and I'm trying to start preaching, like, we want to manage behavior in some ways so that they can learn, but I don't want to take their ability to refuse away, because otherwise all we're teaching is dependence on adults and compliance mm-hmm. without giving them the right, like, no, you can say no, you can say stop, you can say I don't like that, you can say leave me alone. Like, why are we telling kids that they aren't allowed to use that, or we're kind of shutting it down when they show that? I think refusal is such an important skill, and we should really be lifting that up a lot more so that they know, like, you have a voice. I don't want to silence any kid's voice, so I'm very passionate about mm-hmm. We give them the opportunity to voice themselves and say, no, I don't like that, leave me alone, I don't want to right now. That's self-advocacy, and we want to give them that.
It just warms my heart that you have that role in so many kids' lives, and that you're in the education system, that you can teach this new generation that they do have a voice, they do have a choice. I also think I wanted to touch on, you mentioned, like, it's not always just a yes and a no, and there's so many other factors into consent. And I think if we're so focused on, like, the yes and no's, that it doesn't take into account, like, coercion, that sometimes even if you say yes, you don't mean it, that coercion is not consent. If you're feeling like you don't have the option to say no because you're being intimidated or threatened or pressured, they're just like asking over and over again until your no turns into a yes, like you initially said no, there probably isn't something changing that all of a sudden makes you like excited to say yes. You're like begrudgingly saying yes because you're annoyed that they're like continuing to ask. So I think that is important, focusing on body language and tone and all the other factors into consent rather than just the yes and no's.
Yeah. And I think that plays into the culture too. Coercion is a great example, because you're basically teaching, like, I'm thinking of the example of with little kids when they teach, like, oh, if the boy's being mean to you or making fun of you, it means he likes you.
Yeah.
So that's such an example that kind of later could play into coercion, like, oh, well, I can keep going at somebody until I get their agreement, because it's manipulation. It's an abuse of power too. So power yeah. imbalance, and how that is a cultural part of communication. And yeah, that it's not just yes and no, because that's a cultural consideration that happens in that communication between two people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So what has your advocacy encompassed, and what really drives your voice?
Kind of touching back on consent education, this is another turning point that happened for me that I didn't touch on earlier. But one reason I also started speaking out was because, so I'm a speech pathologist. So right. I work with a lot of kids who have communication issues, and some of them are nonverbal. They don't speak at all. So when everything happened to me, I got to a place of thinking about my students and how their voice is more limited because of their communication impairments, because they're nonverbal. And I felt like, you know, it's a gift that I have a voice. It's a gift that I'm able to speak out on this because I have a lot of students who don't have a voice. I'm here to help them have a voice. And that's my main goal, is letting them have a voice and giving them the power of self-advocacy. So that really pushed me to want to speak more. Also, letting other people consider, like, there's so many people that their voices get limited or oppressed, and we need to speak out and we need to lift up not only my voice, but people who are impacted in other ways whose voices are oppressed and limited,
right,
and pushed down. So that was important to me. And when it got hard, because speaking out was still really hard. I mean, it is scary to share.
Yeah.
But that was always in the back of my mind and kind of helped guide me to keep doing it, was knowing that I work with people every day who their voices aren't heard. And I want everybody's voice to be heard. So if I can share my voice, it'll give someone permission to share their voice. And every single time, we're starting to normalize the education on this and teach people, like, what does this really look like? And empathy as well, understanding, like, if you can hear my story and something in my story connects with you, then you might think differently or have more compassion for people in this situation. And I'm changing your belief about how these incidents happen. So I think that was the first point of driving my voice towards advocacy. I think I'm just loud about it on social media a lot. And then it got me to the place of starting the podcast. So that's my main form of advocacy right now, having survivors on the podcast to share their stories so that all the voices we're hearing are survivor-centered and we're seeing them so much more than being a victim.
Mm-hmm. I'm just like blown away. I have chills. Because really, it just sounds like it's so much bigger than you. It's so much bigger than me. And I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, the big picture. And I just had so many moments of feeling like this was my purpose in the world. I think it was a year ago. Every year on my anniversary of the assault, I do a lot to take care of myself, but I don't know why I found this that day, but I looked up what that day meant, like, in the world, like, outside of my own story. What does it mean in the world? And I found out it was the International Day of Self-Care.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that gave me chills.
Yeah.
That resonated with me. And I've had other moments like that just make me feel like Oprah talks about whispers. They come in whispers to show you what you're meant to do. And all the moments of realizing that this is my purpose keep me going.
Yeah, I love that. All right, so to kind of wrap up, what do you want listeners to take away from this episode? And what would you say to someone struggling?
I would say, for someone struggling, you're not alone. This isn't your fault. You're not dirty. You're not gross. Your body is sacred. You didn't do anything wrong. You have the power and they don't. And then if you can find one person to share with, I think that that's so important. And also knowing that in your darkest moments, in your lowest moments, if you can even just call, like, an advocate or a hotline, it doesn't feel good. But I know for me, in some of those moments, I had to do that because you're trying to survive and you want to feel safe. So if you can just talk to anybody. It doesn't mean you have to share with everyone. I've decided to do that, but I don't encourage that. I want everyone to feel safe. So if you can find someone to confide in, just so you have that support, I think support system is so important. And know that there's no time frame for healing. I do this podcast. My podcast voice is not victims, but I am still working on my healing. It's a journey. It's up and down. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. So I would want them to take away that you're not alone. There's a whole network of survivors out there that want to support you. And we've been down this road. We know what it feels like. It's scary, but you're not alone.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So if people want to reach out, connect with you, work with you, where can they find you?
So I'm on Instagram at Voices Not Victims. And then Twitter, they wouldn't let me put an extra S at the end. Like, I guess it is too many characters. So the Twitter is at voices.victim without the S at the end. I just started a Facebook group recently for survivors, activists, nonprofits, and that Facebook group is also at Voices Not Victims. And then you can find the podcast on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and then there's probably a few other platforms. And that's Voices Not Victims. If you search that, that'll come up.
Perfect. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. I have really enjoyed talking with you today, and I'm so proud of you for using your voice. It is very powerful. So to close this episode, ask if you have a song that deeply resonates with you and your story.
And I love that you ask that. I think that's really special. So I was thinking about this, and one song I had played a lot when it came out was by Kesha called Praying.
Oh, me too. Yeah. I love this song.
I feel like it's like she's reading my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It just speaks to me so much. And I love that song because it's how I felt. And it took time to get there because I think also you have to feel your anger. If you're in the anger stage, feel it. You're allowed to be angry. But at the time that song came out, I was a little bit later in the grief process. So hearing her say, like, I hope you find your peace. I hope you see the light. I felt that because I started to wish that for him, that he would find peace and love so that no other women would be harmed. And just fighting for yourself. She talks about fighting for yourself. I think a lot of survivors can connect with that. So that song has spoken to me several times.
Yeah, I love that. I love that song so much. It always gives me chills.
Me too.
All right. So thank you again for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to share with us.
Yeah, and thank you too. This was a really great experience and I really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. All right, so that's all we have for you guys today. Thanks for listening and tune in next time. I hope this podcast left you feeling empowered, better understood, and less alone in this crazy thing called life. If you like what you hear, leave a rating or review and share it with your friends. Thanks for listening and tune in next time.